So we begin Psalm 38. It's technically known or commonly known as a penitential psalm for reasons that are obvious. There's quite a list of psalms that are chosen for the liturgy and called penitential psalms. We've done two of them already, Psalm 6 and Psalm 32. Psalm 51 is the famous, "Have mercy on me, Lord, have mercy on me according to your great kindness," which we'll do at a later date. And then there's three or so more of them there. So in this psalm, the psalmist has sinned. He acknowledges that honestly. But he cries out to God not to leave him in such terrible physical and mental anguish. He assumes, according to the mentality of the time, that suffering is willed by God. And keep remembering, that is an assumption that's right through the Old Testament scriptures, right into the New Testament. You would remember, wouldn't you, when the man born blind in John chapter 9, and they come up and say, "Who sinned, him or his parents, that he was born blind?" So the mentality was rampant even at the time of Jesus, and of course he squashed it out. But then people keep reading the whole of the Bible as though the New Testament isn't there. They read it all as though it's equally true. They read it all on a flat playing field, and they believe Leviticus and Deuteronomy just as much as they believe Mark's Gospel, because it's all true. Do you get the idea? You've got to see a growth of truth, a growth of awareness. So the New Testament stops, even though that idea that punishment is willed by God, I would say, is still reasonably general. Please God, not in this room. But on that assumption, he sees it as a form of punishment for his sin. And I'm not saying sin doesn't have bad effects, and I'm not saying some of the anguish that we have does come from our own sin or the sin of those around us. Of course it does. But we can't make an automatic link between suffering and sin. Otherwise, Jesus' death on the cross would imply that he was a terrible sinner. So this psalmist asks forgiveness, but he insists that those who are maligning him are acting unjustly. So it's a pretty subtle, but I think a good psalm. Let's begin it. Yahweh, rebuke me, but not in your anger. I think you'll find that the New Revised Standard Version says, do not rebuke me in your anger. And I think it's wrong. Those of you who know English will realize that there's quite a distinction between saying, do not rebuke me in your anger. The not is going with the rebuke. Do not rebuke me in your anger. No, our author is saying the not doesn't come with the rebuke, but comes with anger. So he's actually saying, rebuke me. I know I need rebuking. I'm not saying don't rebuke me, but I'm saying when you rebuke me, don't do it in your anger. Distinction's clear, is it? And the Hebrew is this latter. Yahweh, rebuke me, but not in your anger. Discipline me, yes, but not in your wrath. And we've looked at wrath and anger earlier. The word anger is straightforward. Wrath is anger with a bit of fire in it. Okay. For your arrows have sunk into me. Notice your arrows, as though God is doing it. Your arrows have sunk into me, and your hand has come down heavily upon me. So he's feeling very oppressed. Then he goes on to describe this. There is no part of my flesh that is not wounded because of your indignation. There's no sound bone in my body because of my sin. So he acknowledges his sin, doesn't he? Okay. Yes, he says, my guilty deeds are higher than my head. They are a burden that weighs too heavily upon me. And that can be the same for all of us. Our past sins return to haunt us and weigh us down. And we often judge our youth by our wisdom now, if we've got some wisdom, and I presume we have. You know, we're other people, we do too. We judge. It's a dreadful thing to do for yourself, but it's dreadful for others too. And in this vindictive kind of society that's very quick to take people to court, which we've picked up from another country which needn't be mentioned, you know, in that kind of society, very often, people's behaviour of 30 years ago is judged by today's awareness, which is totally, I mean, wrong. So, and that's why we need, in some of you may be in the legal profession, we thank God for that thing that's called epikaya in the technical moral books, that ability not to just judge on the facts and apply the law, but magistrates must always be given plenty of room to move, to look at the circumstances and the motivation and what was going on at the time and make a wise equity judgment, not just simply like a robot could pass the other kind of judgments. You don't need a person to do that. Just press a button and that's the punishment. But there's a fair bit in our, I hear it anyhow, wanting, you know, what is it in judgment? Like three strikes and you're out, or thing, there's a special word for it, I can't think it was, but they want, what the law says is what you should get, and leaving the judge and the magistrate no room for this kind of careful discernment of the subtleties of human behaviour, which we'd always want to be in that wonderful profession of law, which is the fruit of so much beautiful work by so many beautiful people over centuries. We could lose it in the modern era, I think. Yes, he says, my deeds are higher than my head. They're a burden too heavy for me. My wounds grow foul and fester because of my foolishness. What he did, and now he's suffering the results of it. Here's a similar statement, Isaiah chapter 1, verse 6. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there's no soundness in it, but bruises and sores and bleeding wounds. They've not been drained or bound up or softened with oil. So this psalm comes from the psyche of a person who acknowledges guilt, is really disappointed with the mess he's made of his life or her life, and is suffering the consequences now, and unfortunately also putting God on the side of the punishing. That's the dangerous part of this psalm. He goes on to describe his situation, and whenever you or I are like this, well, this will be a nice psalm to go back to feel you're not totally alone. I'm utterly bowed down and prostrate. All day long I go around mourning. My back is burning with pain. In my flesh there's no part that's not hurting. I'm utterly spent and crushed. I groan because of the tumult in my heart. Yahweh, now here's a beautiful part. Yahweh, all my longing is known to you. Underneath this pain, there's a deep longing in this person's heart for God and for life and for truth and for reconciliation and for goodness and for forgiveness. You know, it's all there, but the weight is so heavy. Yahweh, all my longing is known to you. My sighing is not hidden from you. My heart throbs. My strength fails me. As for the light of my eyes, it too has gone from me. And now a dreadful part of it. My friends, verse 11, my friends and companions stand aloof from my affliction. My neighbours stand far off. Friends cross over the street when he comes by. His in-laws don't return calls, you know. The other priests in the diocese don't go near the jail where this priest is, or, you know, whatever it could be in a person's life. The people you're dependent on don't know how to handle it, and they're embarrassed, and off they go, and there's this awful loneliness. So while we're in that mood, let's read Job. It's perfectly fitting for this. Chapter 19, verse 13. He has put my family far from me, and my acquaintances are wholly estranged from me. My relatives and my close friends have failed me. The guests in my house have forgotten me. My serving girls count me as a stranger. I've become an alien in their eyes. I call to my servant, but he gives no answer. I myself must plead with him. My breath is repulsive to my wife. I'm loathsome to my own family. Even young children despise me. When I rise, they talk against me. All my intimate friends abhor me. Those whom I loved have turned against me. So that's the mood of our psalm. It continues in verse 12. Those who seek my life lay their snares. Those who seek to hurt me speak of ruin and think up treachery all day long. But like the deaf, I do not hear. Like the mute, I cannot speak. Truly, I'm like one who fails to hear, in whose mouth is no reply. In you, Yahweh, I hope. You will listen to me, Lord my God. So thank God he's got someone to turn to. Pretty well only God. And in keeping with that, I thought I'd read for you, it's a beautiful chapter. Like, if ever you are really, really, really depressed, okay, read, I suggest to you, Lamentations number chapter 3. Lamentations chapter 3 is the most drawn out, painful description of the human condition internally and externally. The wonderful thing about it, however, that might, if you can work your way through the first 25 verses, which really, because Lamentations is written, it's a poem about the destruction of Jerusalem. So it's, you know, the whole world has collapsed around them. So it'd be the kind of prayer that a Muslim young mother with two kids and lost in Kabul might pray today, you know, where the whole world is just an absolute mess. And at the end of the 25 verses, look at this, verse 26. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of Yahweh. It's good to bear the yoke in youth, to sit alone in silence when Yahweh has imposed it, to put one's mouth to the dust. There may yet be hope. To give one's cheek to the smiter and be filled with insults, for Yahweh will not reject forever. And it goes on even more beautifully to say, in the morning his love is always present for us. I'll let you enjoy that for yourself. And the psalm concludes, and I'll conclude it. I am afraid that they will enjoy my fall, those who make fun of me when I stumble. I'm on the point of collapsing. My pain is ever with me. Now, I confess my guilt. I'm sorry for my sin. Those who are my enemies without cause are strong, and many of those who hate me wrongfully. Those who render me evil for good are against me, because I seek what is good. Do not forsake me, Yahweh. O my God, do not be far from me. Make haste to help me, O Lord, my deliverance.